Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hi, I'm Phil Craig.
And I'm Andrew Loney.
And together we aim to bring you the most scandalous stories and some of the most scandalous people in history. So thanks for joining us here on the Scandalmongers podcast.
Hi, Andrew.
Hi.
Here we are.
A reversal this week. We're having a podcaster appear and we're going to talk to him.
Yes, 2 weeks ago you were a guest on Andrew Gold's excellent new podcast, Heretics. And so we've invited him back for a reverse fixture.
Yeah.
Second leg.
A lot of his followers came to us, so we hope you're listening today and you'll be interested to hear what we perhaps can get out of him.
Indeed. Well, he's got a new book to talk about.
Yep.
All about, secrets, trust, lies, the modern culture wars, all sorts of interesting things, actually, to discuss with him. If you're one of Andrew's followers who joined us, you're so welcome. Thank you for giving us a chance. Surprising number of people in the comments, actually, this week say that they had came because they saw you, Andrew, on Andrew Gold's show.
Yeah, so
hope we can hang on to a few.
Yes, well, welcome, and we'd love to hear what sort of things you want us to talk about. One of the nice things is people seem to be going to the backlist and looking at those, as many really as looking at the recent podcasts.
Yeah, we've had a really good few weeks, actually, and it's been really heartening to find so many people going to shows we made 6 months, 8 months, even a year ago, and watching them and commenting on them. A lovely comment from Kirsty Morris, who's just discovered us. She came to us because of another podcast, or maybe it's a blog, I don't know. Shauna from the Vintage Reader has mentioned us.
Oh, yes.
Has mentioned this to us.
Yes, no, she's great. In fact, she's just reviewed Lady Colin Campbell's book.
Oh, really?
And she's great. I think maybe we should try and get her.
Well, maybe
she's one of our Australian links.
She's been talking about us, and Kirsty Morris checked us out and said how much she enjoyed all the programs. She particularly liked and commented on the one we did with Anne Courcy about Princess Margaret and Lord Snowden.
Great.
So it's lovely and refreshing to have intelligent conversations with fascinating guests, and you seem to get a lot out of them. So there you are. Isn't that nice?
Oh, great. Well, Anne was a great guest, so wasn't difficult.
That was one of our best, I think. A couple of new reviews on Apple, which is very nice to see, because we don't get much data from Apple. From Austria and Denmark. Isn't that good?
Really?
Denmark, I can't see a name. This is from somebody. Just saying, love the juicy scandals with history frosting. Isn't that nice? And then Sylvia from Austria says her English is improving by listening to us, which is good, and that we're not tabloidy. And she also likes Heretics. So there you are.
Great. Great. Oh, well, then you should like today's program.
And actually, my favorite this week, Jonathan Brewer, you've commented before, heard us talking about UFOs and Atlantis and that side of life, and that we might actually do a program, certainly on UFOs. And he says, we need to know, is Phil actually a shape-shifting lizard?
Aha. Uh-huh. So stay tuned. All will be revealed.
Well, talking of revelations, we can confirm that next Sunday we're going to talk to Hannah Barnes. We've been trying to get this set up for ages. And Hannah, she's had an incredible week. She's been spoken about dozens of newspaper articles and in the House of Commons here in London. Politicians from all sides were praising her. She, for her work she's done on the Tavistock story, the story of using puberty blockers on children. And that's been one of the biggest stories this week. And she's coming on our show on Sunday. That's cool.
Yep. Looking forward to that. You know, she's a very interesting, articulate woman. And it's a big issue. And maybe more or less laid to rest, I think, as a result of this recent review.
Certainly when it comes to kids, yes, very big changes are happening. Maybe not all around the world, but certainly in Britain and in various other European countries, yes. And Hannah's been at the heart of that story. And it's not an easy one to tell sensitively, intelligently, fairly. And everybody agrees that she's done just that. So that's pretty incredible, really. We are lucky that we get to talk to these writers of these important books. Talking of which, we have a couple more coming up. They're both friends of yours. And we thought maybe people would like to know and could let us know questions. If they have any questions that they want to ask, you can contact us through the bio. There's a link to an email address. So who is it we're going to be speaking to?
Stephen Davis, who's an investigative journalist, very much in the line of Michael Crick and Richard Norton Taylor, who's written a book called The Truth Tellers, which I think you've also read, which looks at Truth Teller, which looks is basically an account of his career and some of his cases. But I think we've looked at the flight to Kuwait already, but he was instrumental in that, wrote a book about that. We're going to look at the shoot to kill policy. Particularly in Northern Ireland. There's a case I think you worked on as a TV producer about a mysterious maritime tragedy in Estonia.
Oh, yes, that is a terrible, sad, and still a rather mysterious story.
With possibly the intelligence services involved in that. And then David Hooper, who's a solicitor who has been a great champion of freedom of speech, a great media lawyer, is going to talk about slaps. These are basically rich people, particularly Russian oligarchs, using the law courts to suppress very legitimate concerns, particularly books and programs. So he's got a whole series of cases throughout his life he's been involved in. He's going to talk about some of those.
Yes, there's been a lot of that in recent years. And they don't always make the press because they're so effective. People are basically bullied out of writing articles, publishing books by these lawsuits. Aren't ever really meant to come to court, are they? They're just meant to intimidate people.
Yes, they're not about vindicating their reputation. They're really about suppressing and forcing people not to speak out. And it has been had a chilling effect on publishing. I mean, people are steering clear of controversial books because of that. And there have been some very famous cases of a woman who was just doing due diligence on a for a conservative Middle East council, and someone was trying to take it over. And he just pursued her for years, trying to basically destroy her using the courts. And there's some interesting, I heard David Hooper speak last week, and it'll be interesting to hear what he says.
Well, we don't like that. We don't like that at all. So if you've got any questions for David Hooper, or indeed Stephen Davis, get in touch and we will ask them on your behalf.
Yep.
I think that's it, really. I think we've done the weekly notices and the trailer.
Yep. But we love hearing from you. If you've got suggestions of people, we're trying to get someone to talk about the Spanish royal family. That's one of our big things at the moment. A lot of people seem to want that. And I know that Clive Irving is coming back to talk about the relationship with the press.
Yes, Clive Irving's going to talk about. He's going to say some nice things about Prince Harry, maybe to balance some of the things that Lady Colin Campbell said.
Yes, we try to be balanced.
Prince Harry's crusade against hacking. And Peter Pomerantsev is coming.
Of course.
About Putin.
Yeah.
He's a world-class writer who knows an awful lot about the way that Putin and his friends operate and manipulate people. And no doubt use slaps as well, actually. That will probably come up.
So quite a lot of very different things coming up in the next few weeks. And soon, hopefully, when you've delivered, we'll be on to our 2 a week.
Yes, we will. I promise we will go back to 2 a week. Just not quite yet. 60,000 words and counting for the first draft. Gosh.
Okay, I haven't done a single word yet. So
well, you're very quick, Andrew, and you work very hard. I have to say, whenever I email Andrew, he replies whatever time of the day or night. I think he's actually nailed to that desk.
I never leave it.
Yeah, no, I don't think you do. Just to change your jumper occasionally.
Yes, the room is filled with sweet papers and cups of coffee. I haven't left it for years.
Okay, well, that's probably enough from us for now. Let's go talk to Andrew Gold.
Yeah, absolutely.
Come in, heretics.
Well, a slight reversal this week. Instead of Andrew Gold interviewing people, we're interviewing Andrew Gold, who's got a new book out. And
There's the lights. Look at that.
There's the lights. And so I was very pleased
Andrew, come on. This is how we should be doing it. This is proper podcasting technology.
Although it's not working now. This light has gone funny. It's turns on initially, and now it's gone a bit almost off. So I have to get a new one. But
it's
anyway.
It's still good.
He's a lot better looking than our Andrew. I'm sure that's what the people will say in the comments.
Well, the three Andrews, as always. but tell us a bit about yourself, Andrew, and about the book and the podcast.
Yes. Okay. So I am a podcaster and journalist. I initially started by making these kind of Louis Theroux, or if you're American, Louis Theroux books. The son of Paul. I was making documentaries. His father's a book writer, Paul Theroux. About the weird and wonderful. So they were things about exorcism, for example, that's on the BBC, or UFOs. And I was just fascinated by people who are a little bit different or eccentric. And over the years, I've started, you know, my YouTube channel. There's one that's just my name, Andrew Gold. I do lots about the royals on there. And then Heretics, where I've spoken to you about Prince Andrew, and also some of the culture war stuff, quite controversial now. And my book, The Psychology of Secrets, is a sort of culmination of many of my stories looking at weird, wonderful, and extreme people, and also trying to understand what they have in common, which is they keep secrets, and what that does to a person, why we keep them, and who we're more likely to reveal them to. And that's the book.
Before we get into the book, and I really do want to, it's terrific, I wanted to ask you, why are you a heretic? Why are you no longer an insider with the cozy group think? Splashing around with a nice warm bath of everybody else's opinions. What happened?
It's a tough one to talk about, because anyone saying they're a heretic, I think, sounds a little bit David Brent, which is The Office for, again, non-Brits, but it's like, oh, I'm a bit of a heretic, I am. So I don't want to say it too much. And really, all I mean is being willing to talk about things that the mainstream won't. So when I talk with Andrew here, and I suppose for confusion with the two Andrews, I suppose when I say Andrew, I'm referring to Andrew Loney, and when he says Andrew, he's referring to me, unless we speak in the third person about ourselves, which would be mad. When I spoke to Andrew, we spoke about Prince Andrew in a way that many of the mainstream publications might fear doing. In a sense, I wanted to talk about more different kinds of things, and I'd like to as well, because a lot of the videos on heretics now are sort of what we might call a very simplistic term, anti-woke, because that's the stuff that my friends won't talk about. You know, I'm just as concerned by the far right, for example, but I don't have any friends who are far right. But a lot of my friends have been taken by extreme sides of what you might call woke, or very far left, or whatever it is, and that winds me up. And so that's what I focus a lot of stuff
on. Did you find this in your old life at the BBC, that you're pushing at boundaries, that people just were not comfortable to talk about certain stories? I mean, I should say I'm a long-standing former BBC person myself, ex-Panorama, and for a while I ran the factual area of the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. So this is something I've thought about a lot. Group thing.
Well, I was never so much of a BBC insider. I made this film about an exorcism, and I sort of talk about myself as ex-BBC because it's just quicker to do so. But the reality is that I was a freelancer. I had made these documentaries or mini-docs for HBO and some other TV channels, and then I was able to sell this exorcism film to the BBC. So they paid me nothing. I lost money, basically. They gave us some money to pay lawyer fees and stuff like that. So that's what first wound me up a little bit about the BBC, because they portray themselves as this kind of friend of the young presenter, that they lift up young talent all the time. And it turns out it's a very particular type of talent you have to be. And then I spent, after this film, which won awards with them, it won their best of 2018, it was in their list for that, it won festival awards, it did really well. And whenever I tried to get things away with them, the production companies working with them said, look, we can bring this to the BBC, but you're going to have to be off camera because you're a white man, and we're going to have somebody who is from a minority background on screen. Now, at first, I was quite young. I was like 27, 28, and I sort of thought like, well, okay, I'll take this sacrifice, take this hit for the team or whatever it is. Eventually I'll get through. After 6 years of it, I started to feel quite bitter, very rancorous about the whole thing. And I felt the whole thing was being hypocritical. I wasn't allowed to talk about it. I was told that's going to ruin my career and all these kinds of things. So that's what sort of set me off on that
path.
But there's clearly a lot of support for you going out and talking about things that other people won't talk about. I mean, you've got a huge following on your podcasts.
Yeah, and some of the guests you've had are pretty mainstream. You know, maybe you're pushing them further. Andrew, for example, you had David Baddiel I saw on your show. I think you had Dawkins, didn't you?
Dawkins.
Mm-hmm. I mean, these are not extremists by most people's standards.
Yeah, no, well, absolutely. And this is an issue. And it's something I can't talk about now in too much detail. But the book, and that's not me trying to push to talk about the book, because we can do that later. But recently, I've had issues with it because I've had people on who have said that they believe in biological sex. And Dawkins is one of those people, that they believe that no man can be a woman, no woman can be a man. I have no issue with people if they believe the opposite. They're welcome to. If I were a book publisher and they believed those things, I think I might allow them to publish their books, because we need diversity of opinion. But I've had a lot of issues with being invited to talk about my book and then promptly disinvited an hour or two later when they've done a little bit more research about me and seen that I've said these things. So it's a stifling atmosphere, and that's why I think it's popular, because most people don't hold those views. 95% of people, I think, or 90%, they just want to hear views that represent them, and so they come to my channel. And my job really is to try and stop myself from going too far, because that's very tempting. And then you get the sort of Donald Trumps of this world who use that feeling that a lot of people have, which is like no one's listening to us, and they take it to the extreme. And I have to be very careful not to go that way, because, you know, I'll turn into who knows what in a few years' time. So we'll see.
Who's trying to cancel you? Are these university societies? I mean, are they... what sort of organizations, I mean, are stupid enough to invite you and then cancel you once they realize?
Well, I suppose I shouldn't really say the name, but there's an art gallery, for example, and I don't know. I get told snippets through the publisher, because the publisher doesn't want me to go on social media and reveal things about private business meetings, which, you know, I'm liable to do. Because if I'm being told, as I was with the BBC, don't talk about this, it's like either you're doing the right thing, BBC, and these guys, and I should be able to talk about it then, or you're doing something a little bit dodgy, and then that's why they don't want me to talk about it. So there was an art gallery that did that. They said they used the words controversial figure when they disinvited me. There were bookshops that have said, please come and do a public talk about your book, and then an hour later have called up and said, can you actually do it behind closed doors, a little signing in sort of a back room, and they've not explained why. And I said to this one particular bookshop before that, are you absolutely sure I can do a public one? You have the space for it, you have the capabilities, because I'm about to put it on YouTube now and advertise it to my followers. And it's very annoying to put it out, because you can only talk about your book so much without putting off your followers. So I said, are you sure? Because I'm going to put out a thing now about my book. I don't want to annoy them all too much. She was absolutely sure. And an hour later, you know, it's now in a back room kind of thing.
Okay, I promise we will get to your book in a minute, but I just wanted to say, you just reminded me, my friend Malcolm Clark, you've heard of Malcolm, the LGB Alliance?
Right, yes.
One of the leading spokespeople for the LGB Alliance, very distinguished science producer at the BBC and elsewhere, had struggled for a long time to get shows made where he argued against puberty blockers.
Mm.
And I think he would say, and he has said, lost quite a few friends and contacts and invitations to nice events because of this view. And yet it turned out that within the BBC, actually, a reporter who we're interviewing, I think later this week, Hannah Barnes, was doing a major investigation, which, surprise, surprise, came up with the views that Malcolm had been advancing 2 or 3 years earlier, best-selling book, and part of a big change, as we've seen this week in Britain with this CAS review, to the way in which trans-identified kids will be treated. So if the BBC, maybe it's not the BBC, if the broadcasting media in general have been more open-minded to taking various positions on this, rather than saying 3 years ago, 4 years ago, pulling up the drawbridge, unless you say every child must immediately be affirmed the second they think they're in the wrong body, then you're evil and you're not going to work. And I'm afraid that did happen. I hope it's ending.
Do you think there's a fight back now? The fact that, you know, you have, you know, this huge following, you know, that people see this as rather Stalinist, and that people are more open to a wide variety of views, or indeed views which are less woke.
Yeah, I think there is. And I think one of the most frustrating things about that is the very people who stood by some of these things that we're now calling out as dangerous, we now know are dangerous and irreversible, those people have already changed their tune a little bit. And I've seen James O'Brien do this. I've seen there's the woman who got in trouble, who Lawrence Fox got in trouble with saying he wouldn't shag her, which he shouldn't have said. It was a horrible thing to say. Her as well, they've now changed their tune to, instead of, yes, we should allow anything, they say the issue with all of this was the toxicity around the debate. That's what they're saying. And you've got James O'Brien, who I see as sort of a slightly posher Jeremy Kyle, or for Americans, that would be Jerry Springer. You know, he bullies mostly working class people on radio who don't have the same education as him. And it's a horrible thing to do. It's a horrible way to make a living. I would never want to do anything like that. And most of us couldn't do that, just shouting at these people and humiliating them on radio. And he somehow still has, I mean, he wrote a book of, like, How to Be Right or something it was. I mean, what kind of smugness that is. It's just appalling.
Did he include Carl Beach in that? Because
I believe he was an advocate for
a Premier League fantasist whose stories were believed and whose many lives were wrecked by a stupid police investigation, which I think James O'Brien cheered on. Anyway, have to get to your book, and I'm sorry.
I don't need to hurry. I can shout about James O'Brien. I can shout about all these people all day. I enjoy it.
Well, talk a lot about tribalism in media and the way in which some stories, and we did this where we talked about COVID and the origins of COVID. People just didn't touch that story because it became associated with Donald Trump. I can't stand Donald Trump, but I wouldn't let that get in the way, I hope. And that's not the way I was taught at Panorama to do my journalism.
Yeah, 100%. 100%.
People do. So,
yeah,
people sorry, did. Go on. So you've written a very, I'd say, touching, I'd say insightful, rather humane book. It slightly surprised me. I thought it would be you on your soapbox talking about this stuff, but it's actually you kind of investigating all sorts of strange and sometimes rather sad life stories. Is that what you wanted to do when you set out?
And
yes.
And very wide-ranging in terms of the references and the subjects. Extraordinary, yeah. I mean, and new insights into, you know, the Johnny Depp and the Wagatha case and cults and all sorts of things.
Well, yeah, it's interesting you say that. It's something I've discussed with Andrew Doyle of the sort of, he's a sort of free speech activist at GB News. And he is, I would say, the most rational voice at GB News, not to say that there aren't others, but he's like I think he's very, very good. And whenever I've spoken with him, he's also sort of lamented this tribalism and the fact that you then have to do one very particular thing. So he is the free speech guy. And so that's what he has to do all the time. And Andrew Doyle was a teacher. He was a professor of English, and he reviews
taught my daughter.
Oh, did he? That's fascinating. There you go. Well, and funnily enough, he also taught at my school, but after I left, the Merchant Taylors, I think he taught there. We weren't there at the same time. But he said this, and look, on the other side, David Baddiel, who I see as quite woke, he has a lot of quite woke ideas, although not exactly, and he would say that he's very, you know, just, we all like to think that we're not part of a tribe and we just think individually. But he said the same thing, you know, he was talking about Jews don't count all the time, that was his book, and there's this lament we all have of like, gosh, I did enjoy writing that book, I did enjoy talking about that thing, but I wish I could do everything. But unfortunately, the way that our followers tend to work, whether it be YouTube or Twitter or whatever it is, they follow us for one particular thing, and we have to continue doing that thing. And it's a surprise when we do something else. And one of my concerns with the book is a lot of people will come across it just in bookshops, and these people might be quite woke-minded or whatever it is, and they might love the book. And I feel really bad thinking about them then coming across my Instagram and there's a thing saying trans women are not women. And they might then fall out of love immediately with the book and paint me as a bigot, much as I might have done when I was 17 or 18 or something. And unfortunately, that's just a way of life.
The stories you chose, though, were so wide ranging. And yes, I was slightly surprised at the people you introduced me to through the book. Did you set out to do it that way? Or was it just things that came to you through your job that you found interesting?
I think it was a mix. It was, I had these conversations with my literary agent, Donald Winchester, who's just fantastic. And we were looking at how to make this book, because I initially wanted to make a book maybe a couple of years earlier about, and it's not, this is a word that is not YouTube friendly. You won't be able to be monetized if I were to say the word, but I say PDF files to get around that. People who go to playgrounds and you know, what Prince Andrew's been accused of, I suppose, or Epstein, about those people. I lived in Berlin for a couple of years, and I followed around the patients of a clinic called Don't Offend. It was Kein Täter werden, don't become an offender. It's basically, it's this clinic in Germany. It's one of the world's only state-sponsored clinics that doesn't, what is it, mandatory, what's it called again? Mandatory, doesn't have mandatory reporting for these people. So they can come in and see the doctors or whatever, and they're anonymous, basically. And that was a fascinating idea, because in the UK, you have to report these people to authorities. In Australia, in the US, it's the same thing. And so that fascinated me. I hung around or met these people. They were non-offenders, they told me, although some of them had offended, for about 2 years. I wanted to make that book, and I was going to call it We Need to Talk About Max. Max was the first of these people that I met, and he was pretty dodgy, actually. It was a really difficult time meeting him. And we couldn't get that out, obviously. Publishers didn't want it. I actually sent it to Andrew Loney here years ago, and but it was just such a hard sell, that one. But I had that. I had The Exorcist I'd met and all these sort of dark characters. And Donald was saying to me, my literary agent, you know, what do they have in common? And secrets. And at the same time, I was being bombarded with secrets from all of my subscribers who would just, they would start conversations like, hi, Andrew. My first memory is my grandfather putting his hand down, and I'd be like, okay, you know, without even like a hello or nice to meet you, I'm getting these messages. So I wanted to know why that was, what led them to want to tell me of all people. Why are they telling me they don't even know me?
Part of the book you sort of becoming the, taking on the burden of other people's secrets, and people on very short acquaintance telling you the most extraordinary things about themselves.
Well, you're very good at that. I think people do open up to you. You know, maybe they just trust you. But I mean, after all, that's what your podcast is about.
Yes. Well, this is it. And I wondered, okay, so why do they trust me? And I'm sure the same goes for you, as you're both podcasters. And I think a lot of people will experience this if they are teachers or hairdressers or therapists or whatever, any of these kinds of positions of authority. Well, what is it about authority? And what I, you know, I don't mind giving bits away, because I think people read the book, and if they're intrigued, they'll go and read the book anyway. So I don't mind that at all. So towards the end, I start to really figure out what it might be, and I look at quite a lot of surveys and things that have been done with participants and all of that. And it turns out that we think, or humans think in general, that we tell our secrets to polite people, but we actually tell our secrets much less to polite people. Politeness is an indicator of or that they won't tell you their secrets. And there's a big reason for that, I think, which is that politeness in and of itself is quite a nice thing, and it's good, and we should encourage it as much as possible. But when taken quite far, politeness, really, all it really means is adherence to societal norms in a particular time and place. So if you were a polite Nazi, it meant that you would give up a Jew to the police or whatever. You know, if you were a polite Stasi, you would tell on your neighbor. That's what a polite, so why would you tell those people your secrets? And the evolutionary biology stuff, the theoretical stuff, is all a bit theoretical, but you can imagine that over hundreds of thousands of years, that tribes would have sort of God, I lost my train of thought there.
Who do you trust to tell
people
your secrets
giving up to polite people?
Yes.
Gosh. Yes. That if you told your secrets too often to polite people, those would have been the people who would have been shouting whatever the tribal rituals were, going along with the tribe think. You would be dobbed in. You would be told on very quickly. So the ones who survived long enough to pass their genes on, you would like to think are the ones who thought, okay, don't tell the polite people. Who we actually tell are assertive people. We trust assertive people. And I think by the very virtue of having a podcast, you are assertive. You're being assertive. We also trust compassionate people. If you have a podcast and you're listening to people's stories, of course, you come across as compassionate to other people who listen. Now, you don't actually have to be assertive or compassionate. You just have to seem assertive or compassionate. So I think it's a tip for those listening. If you're thinking, hey, I want people I know to tell me more. I want my girlfriend to tell me more secrets. I want my mother to tell me what's bugging her or whatever it is. Try to behave in a way that is a little bit more assertive and compassionate, and I think you get secrets from people.
And what's the most remarkable secret that you found that you put into this book?
I think it was the chapter 9, which is, I call it the worst secret in the world. And I think they don't like me telling it just because they want people to read the book. But as I say, I think people will anyway. And it's a 25-year-old woman who is one of those PDF files that I was talking about before. We're not used to the idea of women, especially young women, having those compulsions or urges or that kind of illness or whatever we would call it. And I went and spent an afternoon with her and her boyfriend, who is 27, who also has these inclinations. And they help each other to not offend. But the reason that it's the worst secret is, you know, the worst secret is something that is, I come to find in the book, related to your identity. That's why it would have been so difficult for Alan Turing, you know, to hide that he was gay in a time where you weren't allowed to be gay. That's so intrinsically linked to your identity that it's going to be an awful secret to keep, and it's going to really affect your physical and mental health. This is the same. Of course, it's not the same as, I don't want to conflate it at all or equate it with being gay when you have that whatever for children, or, you know, for these people at all. I just know that right now that is something that they think of as their identity. And it's also something that would have them utterly socially ostracized if it were to come out, potentially killed if people in their neighborhood, in their village knew what they were thinking in their minds, you know. So that made it the worst possible secret for them. And then me getting it from them was a hell of a burden. It was a really difficult time. I had a horrible afternoon, but a fascinating afternoon walking around this tiny village somewhere in Germany with them.
I thought that there's only a very small part of the book, I'm not giving too much away, on Jimmy Savile and Theroux, and the interview that Theroux did with Savile, which is quite famous. We talked to Dan Davis recently, Dan Davis wrote the book In Plain Sight, which was the basis for the BBC series. He spent years, sometimes spending the weekends with Savile. And that's the dynamics of that relationship when it comes to secrecy are incredible, because Savile wanted to tell him, or rather he wanted to make him think he was going to tell him. And every time he said, I'm leaving, because these interviews are going nowhere, he'd say, oh no, there's something really big I want to tell you. Come back next week. And it's like he was playing with him, but also I think Dan suspected he really wanted to get it off his chest, but never fully did. I guess as a journalist or a podcaster or a filmmaker, persuading people to tell you those secrets, whether they want to or not, is
well, I thought what was very interesting too is when you talk to the undercover policeman or the story of the undercover policeman, people like Mark Kennedy who are infiltrating particularly environmental groups, and actually by the end of it they began to sort of buy into the philosophy of the people that they were infiltrating. But again, what interests me as a biographer is people with dual lives, double lives, and how they reconcile those, and it's that was a very good example of that, it struck me.
So those two points I can get onto. I think so. The Theroux journalism thing, there's an interesting thing that I write that he does, which is that there's a few times I've seen him in documentaries. He does things you wouldn't expect a presenter to do. We're told when we're being a TV presenter on documentaries to there's a lot that you might not.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Realize, so even just like make sure you're standing in the right place so that the camera can see the other person, which seems incredibly obvious, but when you're doing it and you're in the moment, it's not. And not just that, but that the light is on that person, you can't get in the way, you can't have any shadow on them, so you're sort of moving in a very awkward way. And once you know that, you'll spot it a lot on TV documentaries with presenters or hosts, on-screen journalists, they're walking in a strange way to accommodate their interviewee. Louis, one particular scene I depict, he doesn't get an answer from someone when he wants the answer, and the guy is showing him his home. So the guy is saying, hey, let me show you the view. And Louis skips ahead of him. It's a really bizarre thing to do. He skips ahead of the guy who's showing him his garden, and Louis's now in charge. And Louis's now walking around slowly, casually. And when Louis responds to the guy talking, it's not good TV because you're seeing the back of Louis's head. You know, that's weird. And he's experienced enough to know that that's not how it's supposed to be done. And I'm not trying to say that Louis knew exactly what he was doing. I'm sure it's a feeling he has. I don't think he knows, like, I'm going to manipulate this man now. I think he just has a sort of feeling, and he very casually, nonchalantly walks ahead of this guy. Suddenly, the tables have turned. The guy didn't want to tell him stuff. Now the guy's catching up with him and saying, Louis, do you want to? And within a minute, he's told him everything Louis wanted to know. That's something that Louis's very good at. So people say with Louis Theroux that it's that he's so polite, or he doesn't judge. And I put loads of occasions in the book where he does judge. He's extremely judgmental, not necessarily more than any of us, but he does judge people quite vociferously. So it's not that. I think what it really is again, that he's assertive. He's very assertive. He's compassionate, but he's assertive. He goes forward. He goes ahead. He does his thing, and he twists the tables so that people are trying to get him. And I think that's what Saville was doing. I mean, this is a point where Louis was becoming more famous and popular than Saville was, certainly by that point. Saville wants to tell him things. He wants to get things off his chest. And one of the main points of the book is we have something called the fever model about secrets. Again, it's an evolutionary biology kind of thing. But, you know, it would make sense for tribes that the tribes that had individuals within them who felt compelled, as if they had a fever, to get their secrets off their chest would survive longer, because they wouldn't have individuals who are hiding the food quite so often and being duplicitous. So we would like to think that, and the fever model, I mean, it works theoretically a little bit like sickness. You know, a fever comes inside and it makes your body uninhabitable for the fever. And the idea is that it kills the virus before it kills you and you survive. The same thing seems to happen with the secret, both psychologically and eventually physically. You get all sorts of horrible physical results from holding on to too many secrets until you expel them. So it could be that Saville was dealing with these things. We like to think of Saville as a complete psychopath, but you've got to remember that he died clutching, was it the cross, I think? You know, so he must have been a devout believer, and he must have been in quite a panic. So that's why Saville would have wanted to tell Louis.
Well, stuff. I guess the confessional. You know, it's such a deeper religious theme across, you know, many religions, where the priest is somebody sacred that you can confide in.
Absolutely. And you talk about, you know, the murder of Brian Jones and the confession on the deathbed of the man who claims to have killed him, if that's correct. And then you look at it, is this someone just making it up, or is this someone who needs to absolb himself? I thought that was very interesting.
Oh, well, yeah, that's right. So the confession, we have it in most traditional religions. And again, I can only speculate, but I started wondering, is this something that is just human nature, that we confess these things when we die? Or is it a way that religions try to manipulate the rest of the tribe to tell the religion all of their secrets, because we use secrets, and high control authoritarian groups use secrets to control the populace. So, if you can convince the people who are your followers, your disciples, that, oh, you need to tell us everything before you die, or after every crime you commit, we then have these secrets to control the rest of you. So it's a really interesting thing. And I suppose when you are going to die, you have that, you're weighing things up. To what extent do I want to absolve my soul and feel better before I die and maybe go to an afterlife? A lot of people believe in the afterlife and that they'll go to a better afterlife. And to what extent do I want to preserve my reputation here on earth and not tell everyone that I've just killed someone and not ruin these things for my grandson, who's going to find out what I did while I was alive, but potentially go to hell or not be able to get it off my chest for those final moments. So it's a balancing act the whole time about how much we reveal of secrets on our deathbeds.
I mean, you do the Amanda Knox story. How does that fit into your argument?
I think that was a part about how we can know when other people are keeping secrets. And I think even anecdotally, we know that we tend to be overly confident about knowing about other people's secrets. You only have to watch the TV series, The Traitors, the reality show that I've been watching. I think it's just the best TV I've ever seen, because there's no TV I've seen where people betray each other so horribly as on The Traitors. It's fantastic. But for anyone who's not watched it, it's just two or three people are elected traitors. The rest of the group don't know who they are, and they all start to squabble about who it might be. And they talk with just unerring confidence about, oh, I know who it is. And they say, because I'm a magician in real life, so I know, or because I studied law, I know who it is. And they get it utterly wrong. And it turns out that it's not just people on reality shows. High judges and police officers and FBI agents are no better than the rest of us at guessing, just from watching a video, who's lying and who isn't. There's a whole movement on YouTube of like body language stuff. People are body behavior specialists. And I think there is a lot of really interesting stuff to glean from those people. But I think also we have to be really careful not to fall into the trap.
In Amanda Knox's case, her body language was interpreted as that of a guilty person. And she ended up in prison until she was acquitted on appeal.
That's right, four years in prison.
Well, remember the Cindy Chamberlain story, the dingo baby in Australia?
Yeah.
Everybody, because her reaction was to the loss of her baby, was seen as being very odd and cold, idiosyncratic, and oddly religious. She was sort of a member of a particular sect, I think, that they thought, oh, she's probably... And she was, there was no evidence, no physical evidence, but she was basically convicted on the sense that she made people feel about her.
There was a quote, I think it was the prosecutor, and hopefully not the judge, but I think it was the prosecutor in the Amanda Knox case, who said, we don't need the evidence, her behavior is enough, which is like the antithesis of what you should be saying. We should only be looking at the evidence. She behaved in ways that were exaggerated by the press as strange, and I felt them to be incredibly strange at the time. Now, I was like 21 or 22, and we all did, and we all sort of fell into that trap. I challenge anyone now to go and look at those scenes, and it's her boyfriend, Raffaele Solicito, kissing her outside of the crime scene, which everybody made out as this salacious, crazy thing. If you watch it now, it actually just looks quite loving and supportive. He pecks her. It's a little peck on the lips, very, very subtle. The next day, she was out buying lingerie. So, oh, she's gone and bought red lingerie on the day after, but that was because her house was a crime scene. She didn't have any clothes. So all of these things that we just jump to conclusions as pattern seekers as we are, that led to her being locked up for 4 years in prison, which is just, what hell that must be. And all because we believed we knew what she was thinking. We believed we knew about her secrets. Now, there are ways to try and guess secrets and things. There are some body behavioral things that do work, but most of it's not enough, basically. It's not enough to convict someone.
Wow. And you also talk about the Johnny Depp and Amber Heard sort of court case, and that was very interesting because in some ways both of them came out of that quite badly. But again, what was the argument there?
I think that was a scene, and I'm trying to remember through the whole book now, but that was my point of just about where gossip and curiosity come from and how they interact with secrecy. I think, again, I am a little bit maybe too obsessed with the evolution extraordinary stuff, but I really am interested in the whole, you know, what makes us curious. And for example, there were these tests they did on macaques, which are, I think, the most similar to us genetically. And they find that macaques, if you do a sort of competition with them and they need to see if they've won the competition, they'll get some like extra bananas or something if they've won. They will sacrifice some of their bananas in order to know sooner whether or not they've won, because they're curious. So that curiosity we have is what's obviously, I mean, we know we're curious. It's led us to new lands. It's led us to the moon and all of these kinds of things. That kind of curiosity, it sells newspapers, of course. It makes us interested in all of the celebrities, the Meghan Markles and the Johnny Depps and these kinds of things. And it's no coincidence then that the biggest selling things, the biggest, the most talked about things are Johnny Depp and those kinds of things. I think one of the points I wanted to make is the fine line between privacy and secrecy. There's also a fine line between deception and secrecy. But with privacy and secrecy, I found it really interesting because, again, it was something that's very subjective and very much based on where and when you live. So, you know, obviously Alan Turing being gay, for example, was back then a secret. Today, that wouldn't necessarily be a secret. It would just be private. It's just private information. Who cares if the guy's gay? It doesn't matter. So it turns out the secrecy is about the level to which something transgresses societal norms.
It was illegal. I mean, it was a crime. I mean, that was the problem. But it seemed to me also with the Depp and Heard case that here were people making up their own minds on the basis of the people. So a woman wouldn't behave like that, or the people thought Depp was wonderful and thought he was being traduced. I mean, we sort of have it with Prince Andrew. People have jumped to conclusions there, not necessarily, you know, with all the evidence in front of us. And after all, he's not been convicted of anything. So I just wondered if there was an element of that. And of course, one of the things with Depp too was that there were various bots being used to basically false news, to basically push things out, which kind of changed. I mean, we had one case where he won in one country and he lost in the other.
Yeah. I mean, we're in a bit of a complicated mess right now, aren't we? I think one of the elements with Depp that I went into really was, and I've forgotten his name now, that his friend who's an actor who was in Wimbledon. Do you know who I mean? In the tennis.
Paul Bettany.
And yes, it was just interesting.
They went to all the emails, didn't they?
Yeah. And I thought, isn't that a bizarre notion that any email or message you send to a friend, if that friend happens to be in a high-profile court case 10 years down the line, those things are now open to the public? Well, I've said some quite shocking things to friends. In fact, I regularly do. I make a habit of it. If I'm talking privately to a friend, I will deliberately be provocative because it's funny. That's the whole point. So they mimicked this Monty Python scene, and it was, you know, burn her and drown her and all of these kinds of things, which if you take that out of context is disastrous and awful. But that was just a private thing that was said between them and was clearly a joke. We've had other issues with that. Footballer Dele Alli was in trouble for racism. He said something he shouldn't have said about an Asian person, I think sort of Chinese maybe, I don't know, at an airport with his friends in a private text message group. And that got out because one of his friends leaked it, so can't have been a very good friend. And he had to apologize and do a whole thing. And I was really torn about it because on the one hand, I thought, well, these are horrible things you shouldn't be doing. And I'd like to think I would say to a friend like, hey, come on, mate, don't make those jokes. And at the same time, does it mean there is no place now for us to have a private persona away from the rest of the world? And look, the Depp thing, it wasn't just Paul Bettany. Of course, it was Depp himself. The stuff that came out about him, the stuff that came out about her, it was just incredible. And it's incredible that we had access to that. And because it was in America, we had video footage. I mean, in the UK, we wouldn't get that kind of thing. So it was just about, it was a very rare glimpse of the personal lives, not just of anyone, but of celebrities, huge celebrities. And we want access to celebrities, or we want access to real people's private lives as well. We want to know what everybody's up to. I did a survey on several things, like how often do you pick your nose? How often do you do this and that? An anonymous survey with some of my listeners. And, you know, if you're caught picking your nose on camera, it's one of the most humiliating things that can happen to you. And yet, everybody I spoke to says that they do it way too frequently, right? So why is something that every single person does just utterly humiliating if anyone sees you do it? That's a bizarre sort of dynamic we have between secrecy and privacy right now. And I think that's some of the stuff I was getting at with Depp and the Jamie Vardy case as well.
And you make the point also, we're in a surveillance society where, you know, we're all spied on by cameras the whole time. I think you said 70 times a day we're likely to be captured, and how that affects our behaviour.
One of the most interesting for me, because I like the quirky, I'm always drawn to the quirky. I'd been reading Jenny Kleeman's book, Sex, Robots and Vegan Meat, which was brilliant. And she really went and looked into all the different kinds of sex bots that people have at home that are recording them or have been caught recording them. There are toys that people use that were found to have been recording them. So that's the extreme. You can't even have privacy anymore. You know, is privacy
can't
dead?
Trust in your own sex doll. What's the world coming to?
Well, she talks about a world of the future where sex dolls, you know, you can imagine it will be an Alexa sex doll, won't it? It will be one of those kinds of things. And it will be trying to sell you stuff while, you know, and it could even hold back on certain favours until you've like, aren't you going to get this book? Aren't you going to get the review? You know.
And it's all going straight to the Chinese Communist Party. It'll be downloaded. Oh,
yes.
I mean, there is one institution. Don't give secrecy, and you mentioned it, and of course you have a podcast about it too. The Royal Family, there's an organisation that was used for generation after generation to being very secret, even though they sort of lived in public, and never talking about their private business, what the Queen Mother used to say, utterly oyster. And then, of course, ever since Diana, really, and now with Harry and Meghan, you know, all bets are off. You know, everything comes out. Well, I mean, Charles was no better during the divorce.
Yeah.
He and his people were saying the most amazing private details to writers on their side. Does that genie ever go back in the bottle, do you think?
You don't really touch on the royal family, and I agree. It's a very, you know, the mystique, the whole point. I mean, she says, I need to be seen to be believed at one point, but the whole point was there was a mystique there, and they weren't actually. No one was really let in. I would say, Phil, actually, it's a bit earlier. I would say back to the film about the royal family in the 1960s. I think that's when the change comes. And then, of course, it's not helped by having phones with cameras and social media and a less deferential press.
Well, that's an interesting point. Yeah, I did a few pages, really, as near the beginning on sort of Meghan and, the royals. Yeah, usually staying stum, and now even they can't keep secrets. And you're right, it's maybe since the 60s. And there's been an interesting change. I've got this cough. Parasocial interaction, which a lot of people will know, is this interaction we get between talk show host and viewer or celebrity and fan. And it's been brilliantly maybe parodied or taken to the extreme by like Scorsese. What was that De Niro film? The King of Comedy.
Oh,
fantastic film. And The Joker recently with De Niro as well, similar kind of thing where fans become too obsessed. They're now called stans, of course, from the Eminem song Stan. And you stan someone. It's a verb even. You stan this certain celebrity. So that was the sort of 50s and 60s where that started coming along.
Andrew doesn't know who Eminem is.
It's a packet of colourful chocolates. I'm sure you know the song Stan. It's a wonderful song.
Andrew doesn't know the song Stan. I know Andrew.
Do you actually not?
There's a band called The Beatles. He's got into a band called The Beatles recently. He's catching up.
I understand they're a popular music group.
Oh my gosh. Okay, Stan was a rap song about an obsessive fan who goes too far. And so now, because of that song called Stan, people say, I stan this person. It means I'm obsessively in love with this celebrity or whatever it might be. So from the 1950s, 60s, you get this sort of parasocial interaction, which is people starting to feel that talk show hosts are their friends. And the talk show hosts take advantage of this to grow this friendship and say, hey, buy my book. Well, why wouldn't you buy your friend's book? You know, that kind of thing. As the decades have progressed in the last 20, 30 years since we have the internet, parasocial interaction has progressed. And we've not really talked about it that much, about what new word we might use. So I call it reciprocal interaction. Because the fact is now, the talk show host can talk back to you. You know, you can send in all your tweets or whatever it is. The talk show host actually replies to you individually now. So we've really upped the game now. And all the big celebrities are now on Twitter chatting back and forth. And I wonder to what extent the royal family are now at this point where, well, everyone else is doing it. We can't be the only ones staying quiet. And if you don't look at us, we don't really exist anymore. They're becoming, in some respects, less relevant. And I think I might have spoken with Andrew about this, because it's something, my concern for the royal family is they're increasingly trying to become or remain relevant with the youth. And that means talking about maybe woke stuff, or at least quite, you know, social issues that young people are interested in. But that very demographic is the one least likely to cling to them. Really, they need to keep the Conservatives, I think, on board. And so they're sort of damned if they do, damned if they don't, in a very difficult position. Well, what they can do is keep sort of letting secrets out and letting things slip and letting just enough out so that the mystique remains and that people remain interested in them.
Or actually, in a sense, accepting that it is just a sort of soap opera. And just playing that game.
Yeah, they must be, they're aware of it, aren't they?
Yeah, you know, well, we've talked actually this week the about how the relationship between the press and the royal family and how it's controlled and shaped. But in some ways, scandalmongers, we're all about secrets, aren't we? And trying to go beneath the surface.
Absolutely.
And I suppose to have different points of view so that we don't have this groupthink that so often happens. So it's all part of a bigger debate, I suppose, in society.
I think I'm more woke than you, just a little bit. On the scale of wokeness, woke height, I'm maybe a little bit more. I don't know, though. I did want to ask you, though, talking of that bigger issue of tribal thinking and people being very kind of, you know, you're in my gang. And you're not only wrong, you're hateful. You know, you're not only, I don't just disagree with you, I think you're evil. You're probably a Nazi. That approach. I saw that you had John Ronson on. I think he might be a hero of yours, because he wrote slightly similar books, I'd say, to the one you've just written.
Yeah, well, he is a hero of yours, isn't he?
But John Ronson has been attacked recently for selling out his friend Graham Linehan, who, of course, has been another of your guests. And people who don't know, Graham Linehan is a famous comedy writer who did get involved in some very angry and 24/7 social media rows on the issue of trans rights. And he was very much identified as being somebody who thought he was going too far too fast. But he got brutally cancelled, and a lot of his mates dropped him, including John Ronson. Do you take a view on all this stuff?
Well, I sort of did, and I got in a lot of trouble for it. And it's so difficult to know what to say, because there I maybe friendly is too much of you know too much, but acquaintancy with John, and so we met a few times like in New York, and he took me around his favorite places, and he's a very lovely man. And you're right that he was very much a hero of mine, just as Louis Theroux is or was, and so that was really great. And I shouldn't have done this, but I sort of let it slip at some point that John, he was supposed to write a blurb for this book, and then was no longer inclined to do so because of some. And I don't want to name who it was, but it's obvious that he and Graham had this fallout. I gather that they were close friends. John didn't tell me that, but I've gathered from, you know, they were good friends before that happened. And unfortunately, it's just one of those things, isn't it? And, you know, we disagree, and we presume the other person's either hateful or stupid. I like the Hanlon's razor.
Is it always
thing.
Like that? I don't know. But maybe I'm just looking back with sort of, you know, the fond nostalgia. But I remember in the 80s, or even earlier, when Andrew and I at university in the late 70s, early 80s, there was bitter disputes. You know, Thatcher was new. There were strikes. There were riots. Cold War was on. The people were marching about Greenham Common. Do you remember, Andrew? It wasn't exactly a calm political environment. And we used to debate this stuff and argue this stuff. I remember marching against evil Thatcher in my student lefty days. But I had friends who were Tories. I had friends who we would discuss this stuff with and disagree. And it didn't seem quite so...
Well, it wasn't so personal.
Us or them. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it was always a bit like that. And social media has just amplified it. I don't know.
Well, maybe we're getting back to that.
Now to me.
I mean, would you say we may be getting back to a slightly more tolerant approach? The fact that, you know, you have this large following to doing very similar things to us, which is presenting alternative points of view and dealing it in a rational way.
I do wonder, you know, I'm always speculating about that. And I do hope that's what happens. We become more rational. It does feel like 5 years ago, you could not have said there's nothing worse than saying trans women are not women. And it feels like today, yes, it will get you cancelled from going to book signings, but you might say that in polite company and be okay just about. It does feel that might be that I've just gone further and my Overton window has moved and now I'm ingrained with a different group of people. What I'd say is it does feel like it's a very human thing, this tribal thing. I like Hanlon's razor, this idea that, you know, don't assume malice. It's probably stupidity, right? And I don't even think it has to be stupidity. People have different values. It drives me mad when people jump to this thing of like, oh, you said this, so you lied. And it's like, no, you didn't lie. It's just they thought the different thing. Let's not assume the other person's evil all the time. And that speaks to our own solipsism, doesn't it? That we think the only way this person could disagree with me is they're either incredibly stupid or horrible and evil. And that's just not how humans work. Most humans think that they're the good guy. So it's a hard thing. And I have heard from people of your stature in years that it felt less divisive back in the day. But I find that it just feels like human nature. So what I would suggest might have changed, you've got the sort of left and right continuum, don't you? And then you've got the sort of up and down, which some people say is sort of libertarianism and authoritarianism. And when I was younger, so we're talking about the 90s, and it felt like the right was very much entwined with this authoritarianism. You know, don't be gay because of this or that. Don't listen to punk music. That's going to get you doing all the, you know, you can't make a cake for gay people, that kind of thing. And it feels very much like that's moved to the left. And it might be that that's what's changed, is that
censorious left.
Yeah, it was a censorious right. And so we're just seeing it if we are people who might consider ourselves open to quite progressive things. I mean, I'm pro-choice. I'm pro-gun control. There were, you know, almost all of those things I would tick as a 90s sort of left classical liberal or whatever it is. But I'm now seeing my friends saying, ban these people because they've said the wrong views. Whereas maybe 30, 40 years ago, we would have associated that much more with the religious right.
Interesting. We should get Andrew Doyle on our podcast.
Yes, that's good. And coming back to your book, who are you hoping is going to buy it? And what's the message that you want to send out?
I hope that it is the sort of the John Ronson people. I'm torn about who I want to buy it, because on the one hand, it's very much framed as this psychology book. I'm not a psychologist, but I am really interested in that stuff, and I researched it very heavily. But we were very keen, and I was very keen, for it not to feel like a weighty academic psychology book, because it's far from that. So we added my adventures with murderous cults and influencers, because it's got a bit of a John Ronson fun gonzo journalist edge. We made the book cover bright purple and quite kitsch and sort of stand out in that Louis Theroux 90s way, I suppose. His was orange, though. It was more orange colour he had. So on the one hand, people who are very interested in evolutionary biology, what is secrecy? How did we evolve and whatnot? And on the other hand, people who are into true crime and weird stories that journalists have gone and hung out with. So that would, again, be very much John Ronson territory. So I would say fans of John Ronson, that's who I'd like to buy the book.
Well, I hope he does well. I can't believe we talked for nearly an hour.
Fascinating.
I guess it's having another journalist on there. You've ended up interviewing us. It's a sort of subtly.
People open up to you, even when they're interviewing you.
They do.
I wish that were the case. I've not shut up though. But thank you so much for having me on.
No, absolutely, it's been a pleasure. And I hope it's not the last time. Good luck with your book and with the podcast, and get Andrew back on again, because we got loads of followers last time.
Oh bye. Yeah,
and we'll hope that we may give you some of our followers. Who knows?
Yes.
Bye bye.
Well, that was very wide ranging, very interesting. You know, very, I would say, stimulating podcast. Very different from what we've done in the past.
Interesting man. And it's, you know, I'm rather jealous looking at his podcast numbers. It's not been going long with Heretics. It's got a huge number of views and subscriptions. There's obviously a real appetite for people who are prepared to operate just that little bit outside the mainstream.
Yeah, well, that's good. Maybe that's us.
Maybe it is. I think we sort of dip in and out, don't we? You know, I mean, I do worry that, you know, as one gets older, you say, oh, we're just, you know, a little bit anti-woke and all this woke stuff's gone a bit far. But maybe what you're really saying is that you're just turning into a classic old red-faced reactionary. I mean, not you, Andrew, because you're a natural rebel.
I've always been a reactionary.
Well, you're a funny mix, a reactionary, as people know by now, I think. So you're very much kind of like identified with what is seen as a left-wing cause, sort of republicanism, sorry, not republicanism, challenging the monarchy whilst being a monarchist. And freedom of information normally would be seen as something the left would get behind.
It should be something for all of us.
Well, it should be. But as Andrew says, it's this idea of the censorious left that feels something that perhaps wasn't the case 20 or 30 years ago. The left felt a bit more fun and free and funky and not quite so judgmental, angry. I suspect it anyway.
Yeah. Well, yes, we need to see what people think. You know, have people got more censorious? Have people got more intolerant? You know, is there a change? I mean, are people beginning to react against some of this?
Well, it's something we must bring up with Hannah, because I know from what I've heard, the coverage of her book, that it was very hard getting a publisher. And that was often because some of the younger people in the publishing houses, who actually, I believe, wanted this book, said, well, we'll resign. And we'll criticize you. And some of our young authors will refuse to be published by you because you're publishing a book that is particular something that, you know, we all believe in trans rights. Well, most people do. But it was seen, the fact that she was investigating this, what was happening in this clinic, to be going against, you know, what that particular gang believed. And is that gang mentality, that group thing that we've often found, you know, problematic in many of the stories we've covered?
Yeah, which is one of the things that we're trying to address, you know, that everyone, that there are lots and lots of points of view, and they're often equally valid and certainly need to be discussed.
Yeah, and certainly most people would look at Newsnight and the BBC and say, well, you know, if you're criticising it, most people would probably think it was, you know, soft left, centre left, not really a right-wing organisation, which you might say of, I don't know, Fox News. And yet the fact that somebody within the BBC found it's very difficult to tell this really important story is interesting. We must dig into that with her.
Well, yes, it's about orthodoxy and going against the orthodoxy. And that's something that we don't do.
No. Well, I think we're just very lucky. Like, I think we're just very lucky that we get people like Hannah and other fantastic writers to come and talk to us.
Yes, no, we've been very lucky. It's a very classy series of people.
Yes, it is. And that's all because they know they have an audience, which is you people. And thank you for being that audience. I hope you enjoyed, Andrew. Please come and listen to Hannah, because I think that's going to be really important.
Yep. And we're very proud of our thank you button, aren't we? A number of people have very kindly pressed it, and that's really helping us. I think you're going to be able to buy a microphone and possibly a new camera.
Saving up for a decent camera and a microphone. So if you feel the need to give us a couple of dollars, pounds, euros, just click on the thank you button.
And see you next week.
And see you next week for Hannah. Thanks a lot.
Till then. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Scandalmongers podcast. This has been a Podcast World production. You can get in contact with our show by emailing team@podcastworld.org, placing Scandalmongers in the heading, or via our social media links within the show's bio.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices.
Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.